Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Melodies of Myth, where we explore short historical tales blended with Indian classical and Western music. I'm your host, Simar Kaur, and it's an honor to accompany you on this journey of discovering the rich interweaving of music and history. Together, we will explore the stories, traditions, and timeless melodies that have shaped our understanding of this art form. Time for our weekly story. Imagine, it's a night in northern India. The sky is clear, the stars are sharp, and the air is still. Suddenly, from somewhere unseen, a single sound emerges. the low, breathy voice of the bansuri, or commonly known as the bamboo flute. The note bends gently, almost like moonlight slipping across water. It doesn't demand attention, no. It pulls you in. You can almost imagine the trees swaying a little closer, the air itself leaning forward to listen. For centuries, the sound of the flute has carried this reputation. It is not just music, but a force that blurs the line between human and nature. Indian classical musicians have long believed that a single song, played with sincerity, can awaken emotions, summon seasons, and change the very mood of the world around us. And to understand this, we need to talk about a central idea in Indian classical music, the ras. Ras literally means essence or flavor. It is the emotion that a piece of music is meant to awaken in its listener. There are rasas of longing, tranquility, devotion, heroism, love. Each song, the melodic framework of Indian classical music, or the rag, is designed to embody a particular ras. But it goes further. These songs are tied to the time of the day and even the season when they're sung. For example, Rag Bhairav, performed at dawn, is said to capture the awe and sincerity of the early morning. Rag Yaman, played in the evening, conveys calm devotion. Rag Megh is linked to the monsoon rains. Its notes are said to carry the scent of the wet earth. In this way, music isn't just entertainment, you know, it's a world of feeling. Once you step into, like, it's like walking into a dream where time, weather, and emotion, they all blur together. And before we carry on into our story, here is a song that highlights the bansuri or the bamboo flute. Enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Among the instruments of this tradition, the flute has always been special. Unlike the veena or the sitar, the flute is carved from a single piece of bamboo, so simple and yet capable of infinite expression. Its sound is the closest to the human breath, actually, and to hear the flute or the bansuri is to hear life itself carried through music. Stories about music's power often swirl around this humble instrument. Some are almost mythical. They say that when rag Meghmalhar is played with mastery, clouds gather and rain begins to fall. When rag Deepak is performed, lamps burst into flame. Musicians like Tansen, the legendary court singer of Emperor Akbar, were said to command these powers. He was challenged once to sing rag Deepak, the fire song, and his voice was so charged with energy that it actually lit lamps across his court and nearly burned him alive. And only the cooling rains of rag Megh, sung by another musician, could save him. Whether or not these stories are literally true, they do reveal something deeper, the belief that music is not passive. It acts, it changes, it transforms, and the flute, because of its intimacy with breath and silence, is at the heart of this enchantment. But melodies only have the spell. The other half is the rhythm. Indian classical music uses intricate rhythmic cycles, from the simple 8-beat teen tal to complex patterns of 11, 13, and even 16 beats. In a live performance, something magical happens. The audience begins to feel the cycle with the performer. People start nodding, clapping softly, or they start tapping their knees. They wait for that climactic moment when the improvisation resolves back to the sam, the first beat of the cycle. Imagine being in a mehfil, which is a small room filled with listeners. The air thick with incense and anticipation, and the bansuri or the bamboo flute weaves delicate phrases. The tabla answers, and suddenly the entire audience leans forward as one. The musician lands on the sam, perfectly timed, and the room erupts in joy. In that instant, community and music are indistinguishable. This tradition is ancient, but it is not frozen in time. Today, these songs echo in Bollywood soundtracks, in global fusion concerts, and even in pop songs touched by tabla and bansuri. The grammar of Indian classical, the rag, the rhythm, the melody, they have been adopted, reshaped, and even shared across the world now. Even here, thousands of kilometers from India, the sound of a single flute note can still hold a room in silence. And so, the enchantment of the flute continues. It is more than bamboo and breath. It is memory. It is mood. It's a myth. A single phrase in the right song can carry us to dawn, summon a storm, or open the quiet corners of our hearts. Whether it's a 15th century emperor court, or a campus radio station in Kingston, this song still flows, timeless, borderless, and alive. Up next on Melodies of Myth, we have a beautiful flute piece by one of Canada's finest. Before we listen, I want to introduce you to the artist behind the sound, Joanna Frohrer. Born in Vancouver, Joanna hails from a family of professional musicians. From early on, the flute wasn't just an instrument for her, it was her voice. She studied with Kathleen Rudolph in Vancouver, then went on to refine her artistry at McGill, working with Timothy Hutchins. At the age of 20, she was appointed principal flute of Canada's National Art Centre Orchestra, one of the youngest musicians ever to hold that position. And since then, she's performed as a soloist, chamber musician, and educator, with a repertoire ranging from Mozart's quartets to Rodrigo's flute concerti and beyond. She's also on faculty at both the University of Ottawa and McGill University, sharing her love for tone, phrasing, and musical color with the next generation. So here is her piece, bringing the artistry of the flute to life. Listen closely to how every note seems to float, to articulate not just melody, but emotion. Here is the next piece by Joanna Frohrer.
This is the sound of 100 children playing without a care in the world. Except for 12 of them. Because 12 of every 100 children live in poverty and are probably hungry. Let's make sure food banks are full for anyone who needs them. Just $16 donated to Feed Ontario can provide lunches for a hungry child for 1 month. Learn how you can help at feedontariotogether.ca.
And with that, our journey here today on Melodies of Myth comes to an end. I hope you all enjoyed and got to reflect back on these beautiful tunes and the sound of the flute. You've been listening to Melodies of Myth with me, Simar Kaur, here on CFRC 101.9 FM, Queen's Radio. Meet us back here every Friday at 3 p.m. for another journey into music and storytelling. Until then, take care, keep listening, and may you always find a little melody in your everyday life. See you next Friday at 3 p.m.
Jack Ayala, one of CFRC's marketing assistants at the station. CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, donors also earn one more ticket for each of our weekly raffle draws, featuring prizes from wonderful local businesses including Harper's Burger Bar, Hotel Wolf Island, Kingston Canadian Film Festival, KPP Concerts, Long M. McQuaid, Mighty Birds, Pokeworks, and Novel Idea. Enjoy the benefits of donating and give today via CFRC.ca.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM continue to bring the heat this fall with a stacked lineup of local concerts. At the Broom Factory, you can catch country star Robin Ottolini on November 20th, Virginia DeVegas on November 21st, Queens grad Charlie Houston on November 28th, Stephen Stanley with No Electric on November 29th, Bat Sabbath on December 13th, folk icon Garnet Rogers on December 14th, and local rap hero Slaves of Spanky on December 19th. And don't forget to get your tickets now for the big show by Canadian alt faves, the Strombellas, playing Kingston Grand Theatre on November 23rd. For a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com. And don't forget to donate to CFRC's funding drive via cfrc.ca, where you may win $50 vouchers redeemable for KPP Concerts.
I've outlived so many of the men in my life. The most painful has always been, will always be, outliving Michael.
Poems from Outliving Michael, a new book of poetry by Stephen Rains.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Our news wrap crew took the U.S. holiday weekend off, but next week they'll catch up on this week's stories, like the key marriage equality court rulings in Japan and the European Union. On this week's special show, we commemorate World AIDS Day with a reflection in poetry and the press.
Michael's days totaled 15,532.
15 members left red handprints on the walls.
But first...
Somebody sing.
Hello, hello, hello.
Somebody sing. Somebody cry.
Why?
There is panic and an increase in mental health distress and anxiety among gay men and other men who have sex with men, according to Jeffrey Walimba, programs manager of Nairobi, Kenya's Ishtar MSM. Walimba says there is a lot of fear because people are not sure what is happening. What is happening is documented in a UN AIDS report released ahead of World AIDS Day entitled Overcoming Disruption, Transforming the AIDS Response. UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Bayanaima sees that sudden funding cuts to international HIV work, together with increasing attacks on human rights, have been devastating. The report finds that Anti-queer and anti-rights movements are growing in influence and geographic reach, jeopardizing gains made to date on the rights of women and girls, people living with HIV, and LGBTIQ+ people. Despite the current obstacles, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' World AIDS Day message strikes an encouraging note.
The progress we have made is undeniable. Since 2010, new infections have fallen by 40%. AIDS-related deaths have declined by more than half, and access to treatment is better than ever before. But for many people around the world, the crisis continues. Millions still lack access to HIV prevention and treatment services because of who they are, where they live, or the stigma they endure. Ending AIDS means empowering communities, investing in prevention, and expanding access to treatment for all people. It means uniting innovation with action and ensuring new tools like injectables reach more people in need. At every step, it means grounding our work in human rights to ensure no one is left behind. Ending AIDS as a public health threat by 2030 is within grasp. Let's get the job done.
Not all UN members are in line with Secretary General Antonio Guterres in pushing to get the job done. Among the countries rolling back their support for HIV/AIDS prevention programs are France, the United Kingdom, Germany, and the United States. The Trump administration has even banned any official recognition of World AIDS Day by the U.S. government.
AIDS kills. Respect this, America is dying slowly. AIDS kills, word up, respect this, America is dying slowly. AIDS kills, word up.
Outliving Michael is a new book by Los Angeles-based poet Stephen Rains. It's a memorial memoir chronicling Stephen's profound friendship with Michael Church from 1994 until Michael died of AIDS in 2000. The book is captured by Brian DeShazer's original sound collage using Stephen's reading of poems from Outliving Michael, juxtaposed with news rap reports from This Way Out's archives. The soundtrack is drawn from some of Stephen and Michael's favorite music.
His father did the books for Steve Rebell, got Michael a job as a bottle boy at Studio 54. Michael said, "I probably picked up 3 bottles that entire summer. He spent most work hours on the dance floor. I smile thinking of him, strawberry-haired, sweating, in a white T-shirt, bar rag in his low-slung jeans, bottle of poppers in his pocket as he danced. AIDS was already in the room, but not in his body. And no one knew anything anyway. There was just the dancing, sweating, sex, drugs, and disco." Michael told me the story only once about the time Ramon hit him. He acted like this was a secret not to be shared. But I could tell he had refined it, rehearsed it, so it wasn't the first time or even the 5th time he had told this story. They were in Spain. I can't remember where, but I imagine it was Rodon, the cliffside city full of twisting roads. The two of them left dinner. Michael, young and upset at Ramon, driving dangerously, erratically. Ramon demanded he pulled over. Once outside the convertible, Ramon promptly hit him. Then, in a mixture of Spanish and English, told Michael to stop with his dramatics. Michael said that moment changed his life, slapped him out of childishness. "If anyone had told me that a lover would hit me and I'd stay, I'd think they were crazy."
I'm Tori Christopher.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 29th, 1997.
Join us
who would only provide care to a person with HIV in a hospital setting, and a government appeal in the long-running case of the so-called NEA 4, three of whom are openly gay or lesbian, who were denied grants by the National Endowment for the Arts based on a decency clause imposed by the Congress. And finally, another World AIDS Day observance is billed as the first electronic march on Washington, the AIDS Action Until It's Over e-march. President Clinton is...
Life is short. Death is long.
Action website, www.aidsaction.org. One press release describes the electronic event as one that will take most of the headaches out of traditional marching, including the inevitable disputes with police as to how many participated, and the unpleasant necessity of rows of porta-potties.
I've outlived so many of the men in my life. The most painful has always been, will always be, outliving Michael.
And I'll turn right back around. Give me one reason to stay here, and I'll turn right back around.
I'm wearing a necktie on my forehead, Michael said over the phone. Like Olivia Newton-John in Physical? I asked, laughing at the thought. Exactly like her. There was a new dress code at the travel agency, requiring a shirt and tie, but Michael rebelled. They didn't say where the tie was to be worn. I, a notorious rule follower, was concerned. Aren't you afraid you'll get fired? But Michael was confident. I'm the best agent in here. They can't get rid of me. He made himself indispensable. Could not get fired, no matter how flamboyant he acted. Gayness was reason enough for termination. They never would. They need me too much.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Brian Nunes.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 6th, 1996.
Men who get together to sing, and one of the things that does bring us together is the fact that we are gay, because we are the London Gay Men's Chorus. And by the very nature of a group of gay men getting together to sing, especially the choice of music that we do sing, we will be making a statement whether we choose to or not.
It's a pretty eclectic choice, isn't it? Everything from pop songs to the South African national anthem.
Well, we like to keep it as diverse as possible, simply because it makes it interesting for the audience to listen to. And as we are going to be singing these, we wouldn't want to be pigeonholed into just singing just church music or show music or whatever. By keeping it as broad as possible, it keeps everybody interested in what we're doing.
I'm going to let you go over to the other side of the studio and pick up the baton, and we're going to hear a pop song that I think hails from the 60s originally. This is the London Gay Men's Chorus with Dadu Ron Ron.
Men upon a Monday and my heart stood still. Da-do run, 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 da-do run, run. Somebody told me that his name was Bill. Da-do run, 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 da-do run, run. Yeah, my heart stood still. Yeah, his name was Bill. And when he walked me home, da-do run, 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 da-do run, run. Yeah, da-do run, 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 da-do run, run.
With members of the London Gay Men's Chorus, that was Petruk Trelawney reporting.
Michael bequeathed me his humor via payphone in the Atlanta airport. My long-distance romance over, I was flying back to Florida, single again. Michael didn't like him anyway. When I excitedly told him he had two cars, Michael asked, "Why? They're not shoes." As Michael heard my disappointment, I spotted an older man watching me, rubbing his crotch. I whispered the details to Michael, who asked, "Well, how is your herpes?" Confused, I blurted out, "My herpes." The man heard me, and his hand moved like lightning away from his bulge. Michael howled with laughter, fed me line after line of disgusting and outlandish diseases and situations. He was a long-distance ventriloquist, pulling strings through the phone line, giving me his quick wit and cadence.
Just a friendly little
second to last year, Michael had trouble getting hard. Viagra was a miracle drug all over the news and late-night monologues. But his doctor said he didn't need it or sex, not so subtly hinted that Michael was a danger to others. I told him I'd ask around. Bought two pills from a fast-talking drug dealer my friend Eric was dating, who warned me about side effects, upset stomach, abnormal vision, and to avoid grapefruit. I paid $40, a stretch for me at that time, and never asked Michael for the money. I mailed the pills and closed a note. I want you to be happy. I want you to f*** your brains out. After Michael's death, I rushed into a relationship, thinking I would avoid grief. Then, back in Florida, a whirlwind of odd jobs. Doorman, bartender, underwear model. While getting an HIV test, I decided to volunteer. The organization's demographic was black gay men, which must have made my white face a surprise. I worked with high-risk youth, didn't mince words or shame, used matter-of-fact messaging. I told hundreds they were HIV positive. It was hard. The pain was terrible. It was as if my life had been consumed with HIV. Friends were worried about me at my job and how it devoured my life. I assured them that I was fine, that similar to the Florida hurricanes I had lived through, the calm was being in the center.
Affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 15th, 1995. In the U.S., ACT UP San Francisco invaded their local Republican Party headquarters on July 11th. 15 members left red handprints on the walls, waved anti-Republican banners from the balcony, and hanged in effigy California's Governor Pete Wilson and Attorney General Dan Lundgren, as well as the U.S. Senate's chief opponent of AIDS funding, Jesse Helms. Four protesters were arrested. ACT UP spokesperson Michael Bellefontaine promised that demonstrations would continue through the 1996 national elections to protest what he called the Republican Party's homophobic and AIDS-phobic agenda.
I wasn't drunk, just desirous of the dark-haired photographer with big eyes and romantic accent. We f***ed without abandon, and regrettably, without a condom. It wasn't a death drive, but rather a zest to live, and maybe a way to share more with Michael. But I did not want to die like him. The next day, I made calls to my doctor, the GMHC, and the AIDS hotline, asked about what I had read about, post-exposure prophylaxis, the treatment for needle sticks and condom breaks. I hadn't had an accident, but a lapse in judgment, and hoped they'd still help me. The treatment so new, my doctor knew nothing. My other calls got transferred from staff to staff. I was told I had less than 24 hours from exposure to take it. Found the medication and dosage, called my doctor, begged for a script, rushed to the pharmacy across town that had HIV meds, waited in a long line. When I think of myself at 26, that's what I see. Cordless phone in my hand, while I dialed for my life to live.
Did you bring it?
I forgot it.
Forget it. Next time, don't forget it. And every time, make it part of the relationship.
A latex condom used consistently and correctly prevents the spread of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, and may save your life.
That's one of several U.S. government-sponsored AIDS prevention messages that TV and radio stations began broadcasting January 4th, the strongest promotion of condom use the federal government has ever undertaken. Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala offered this rationale for the Centers for Disease Control's new targeting of young people with messages promoting condom use.
Young adults need to know that the surest way to prevent AIDS is to refrain from having sex. But we also need to be realistic. By age 20, 86% of young men and 77% of young women report having intercourse, according to the CDC.
Although some U.S. AIDS activists wished the public service announcements were more explicit, they were pleased to see the Clinton administration taking a much stronger position on condoms than its Reagan and Bush predecessors.
You're listening to a sound collage featuring selections from Stephen Raines' Outliving Michael, read by the author on This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. The book is published by Moontide Press.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Turn to this special presentation produced by Brian DeShazer.
At the end of 2000, I read Christy McCall had died, was hit by a boat while swimming with her children. I cried, talked about her to anyone who'd listen. I sat teary-eyed across from my therapist. He asked if it was misplaced concerns about the new year. Only now, all these years later, I realize it was about Michael.
Thank you for the days, those endless days, those sacred days you gave me. I'm thinking of the days.
I'm Leo Garcia.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 8th, 2000. In Scotland, a lawsuit charging the city of Glasgow had violated Section 28 with its funding of gay and lesbian and AIDS groups was settled this week. Last month, the Scottish Parliament voted overwhelmingly to repeal the clause. In the settlement, the city admitted no wrongdoing, but agreed to write letters telling the community groups they could not use their city grants to promote homosexuality. As the groups see it, that makes no difference in what they've been doing already.
Michael gave me a copy of Dancer from the Dance, told me it was his memoir. I held the book and laughed. This is a novel by Andrew Halloran. But he said it was the closest thing to his own life he had ever read. When The Beauty of Men came out, Michael bought it at the mall, and it sat on his nightstand for years. The jacket, covers, colors matched his decor, and knowing Michael, this is why the book stayed there. The last Halloran book Michael read was In September, The Light Changes. The glossy paperback had a railing overlooking the ocean, blue sky, and a ghost-like figure looking out into the water. I didn't read it then, though I could have when I sat on his couch in those months I stayed with him in Naples, or on those long afternoons he spent in bed sleeping or watching TV with the dog by his side. His dementia frustrated him so much that he threw his cordless phone on the lawn. Those last few months were terrible. I tried to take care of him and I couldn't. Our May-September friendship didn't allow a restructure. He wasn't so accepting, and I, so young, wasn't a good caregiver. He painted his living room salmon because it went from bright in the daylight to a soft warm in the evening. When Michael died, the light changed for me. His walls lustered a little less. My life did too. 6 years after Michael's death, I held Halloran's latest book in my hand. The title still, even all those years later, aptly fitting, Grief.
NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending December 3rd, 1994.
The 7th annual World AIDS Day was observed around the globe on December 1st. Most events were peaceful, but some were not. In Madrid, dozens of demonstrators clashed with a handful of anti-abortion protesters carrying a banner which read, "Promiscuity causes AIDS." The AIDS demonstrators responded by spraying them with red paint squirted from syringes. According to eyewitnesses, police refused to intervene. Spain has the fastest growing AIDS rate in Europe and a vocal anti-choice movement supported by the Roman Catholic Church.
In London, members of the direct action group Outrage warmed up for World AIDS Day on November 27th by storming into Sunday Mass at Westminster Cathedral to protest the Vatican's opposition to contraception. "Condoms stop AIDS, condoms save lives," they chanted, as stunned parishioners watched 55 helium-inflated condoms and a huge banner float up and lodge in the 123-foot-high central dome of Britain's main Roman Catholic cathedral. Outrage spokesperson Peter Tatchell said the 55 condoms represented the number of people in the world who would contract HIV during the group's 10-minute protest.
The stories of a life. 1. Michael accused me of doing my hair with a blender. 2. He was upset with his dog Daisy for in the walk-in closet, but the soaked carpet made him realize that it was his own, drunk from the night before. 3. Michael took me to his friend's birthday party, brought a very fancy lamp. Right before we walked in the door, he said, "Ugh, I'm going to have to put this lampshade on my head." And that's how he rang the doorbell. 4. 5 nights after a plane crash, a drag queen with a plastic airplane on her head threw paper airplanes into the audience while lip-syncing John Denver's "Leaving on a Jet Plane." Michael tipped her $50. 5. Michael told me my dancing reminded him of Elaine from Seinfeld. 6. Michael roasted lamb to celebrate my associate's degree. He told me that with my degree and a dollar quarter, I could get a cup of coffee. 7. I drank only white Russians with Michael, his drink of choice, and I haven't had one since. 8. Once, in the Galilee parking lot, Michael narrated a drunk man's bumblings as if he were Howard Cosell, describing every step and stumble until the man fell into the bushes. We laughed until the medics came. 9. When my 5-year relationship ended, Michael thought he'd never hear the end of it and praised me for only mentioning it 3 times. 10. Cool Joe's Barbershop advertised $5 haircuts. Weeks later, a salon across the street put up a sandwich board. "We fix $5 haircuts." Michael had to pull his car over from laughing so hard. 11. On Thanksgiving, Michael left a message on my answering machine that was just him gobbling. 12. On July 4th, Michael shouted a message on my answering machine, "Happy Codependence Day." 13. Michael had a side table filled with photos of his friends who had died. He called it the dead table. When I arrived late to his house once, I found he had put my photo on it. 14. When a pretentious filmmaker said his movie was a gift to the world, Michael said, "I really hope he kept the receipt." 15. He told me in each relationship, there's one person who loves the other more. In the best of relationships, each person believes they are that person. 16. Michael's days totaled 15,532. 17. Michael handed me a copy of Dancer from the Dance, said, "It's my life. Read it." When I gave it back to him a few days later, I said, "He dies in the end." Michael said, "It's my life."
The bestest pal you ever had. There'll come a time, now don't forget it. There'll come a time when you'll regret it. Oh, baby, think what you're doing. My love.
You have been listening to a presentation of selections from Outliving Michael, poetry by Stephen Rains. The book is published by Moontide Press, and the audiobook, as read by the author, was engineered by Lightwise Media. For information on how to get your copy of the book, visit Stephen Rains, that's StevenReigns.com. This exclusive feature was produced and edited for This Way Out by Brian DeShazer with permission from the author. Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Brian DeShazer produced this week's Outliving Michael special feature starring poet Stephen Rains. You heard music from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite and by Sylvester, Tracy Chapman, the London Gay Men's Chorus, Connie Vinette, Eartha Kitt, Christy McCall, Pachelbel, Judy Garland, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Wu-Tang Clan, and Tristan Barton. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley celebrating their 50th year together, and all the listener donors who make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on 2MCE Bathurst, New South Wales, KPCA Petaluma, California, WBDY Binghamton, New York, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
Visit the Screening Room, Kingston's only independent movie theater located downtown at 120 Princess Street. They specialize in playing art house, international classic, and cult cinema, along with Hollywood's best new releases. People also always say they have the best popcorn in town. Visit Screening Room at screeningroom.com for upcoming show dates and ticket information. Shoelace, first time.